Welcome to the NSPCC Learning Podcast, where we share learning and expertise in child protection from inside and outside of the organisation. We aim to create debate, encourage reflection, and share good practice on how we can all work together to keep babies, children, and young people safe.
Hi, and welcome to the latest NSPCC Learning Podcast. This is the first of two episodes recorded last month, September 2021, that focuses on neglect. Dawn Hodson, the NSPCC's Associate Head of Development, spoke to Mandy Tamburini-Moore, a family support worker for Liverpool Children's Services, Lisa Shannon, the Grady Care Coordinator from Stockton-on-Tees Borough Council, and Sharon Graham, an early help manager at Shropshire Council. In this first episode, Dawn, Mandy, Lisa and Sharon discuss what neglect is, the difficulties with assessments and some of the harder to spot forms of neglect. They then move on to discuss issues and challenges that arise in relation to children's ages and stages, covering early years, adolescence and additional needs. Throughout the conversation, each professional talks about what they've learned from their experiences working with families and what they find works when supporting families.
We're going to start off by having a little bit of a conversation around why neglect is difficult to understand, difficult to assess, and why the word itself, neglect, is difficult for families. So, Sharon, do you want to just share something about your understanding of the assessment of neglect and why it's difficult for families to understand what neglect actually is?
Well, in my experience, I've worked with families who have had very little understanding of the word neglect. They've been worked with a number of professionals over a number of years around home conditions, around healthy food on the table, around children going to school, around some quite extreme situations of lack of emotional warmth and attachment. But nobody's actually sat down and said to them, this is neglect, or neglect has been a term that's been used very much in passing around the type of category of child protection plan they might be on, for instance. Nobody's sat down and explained exactly what that means to them and their situation. And when I've spoken to families in those types of situations, the feedback that they've given is, if somebody had sat me down earlier and pointed out what neglect meant to my family and my situation, I might have been able to have put some changes in place. They've also reflected on the fact that when they've heard the term neglect, they've thought of the black and white NSPCC adverts on the TV, or the child who goes to school in winter without a coat, or the photographs of filthy houses, or the serious case reviews that they've heard about in the news. Nobody's ever stopped and said to them, okay, so for you, we are working with you around neglect. It's not a nice word. It's not a nice term. Nobody likes to hear it. It's quite threatening. But this is what neglect means to you, your children and your family's situation. And I think that's quite frustrating, because we have seen families who've had services involved for a number of years and the end result is that their children have been removed. We've seen others that have been successfully worked with, but the use of tools such as GCP2 and the use of kind of that shared understanding, not jargon, but plain talking and plain simple support with families works. And I think that the stigma around neglect is what prevents professionals very often from using the term. Yeah. And that doesn't help the families or the children living in those situations. So it's difficult without the explanation to be able to relate that into real life.
Brilliant.
And, you know, we've all worked with families who have said, but my child has their dinner every night, or my child does go to school, or they have got shoes, but they don't understand that not giving them a cuddle, sitting down and having conversations with them, interacting with them, walking them to school and being part of that school day, they don't see any of that as being that kind of gap around the parenting and the neglect in their situation.
Yeah, brilliant. So Mandy, is that similar from your experience as a frontline practitioner?
Yeah, it is. In fact, that with some of the families that we've worked with, it has been that nobody's actually sat them down. It's this word neglect means a child that sits in a corner and is weeping and crying, and it's black and white, and but that's not true for them. Their child, they've got other siblings to play with, so why would they need to go out anywhere? Why would they need to celebrate a birthday? Because, you know, they're all happy themselves, because we've found that not having any celebrations is something that they think is okay. Well, they don't need to. They know it's the birthday. They've got a card. It's okay. And it's that kind of like nobody's actually sat down and said, well, how would that feel if you didn't celebrate that? How does it feel if you're the child who doesn't achieve their goals? Because you haven't spent the time to sit down with them and to enjoy the time to read a book, to enjoy that time to have homework with them. And they're looking at you. Families are looking at you though to say, well, I didn't realise that's what neglect was. That's a form of neglect that I thought it was about me not washing the clothes, not doing the cleaning up. And I do all of those things. It's like not saying to them, how's your day been today? Mm-hmm. You know, and that emotional warmth. And they haven't quite linked neglect to that area of life.
So do you think we, when we're working with families, need to be clear and honest? Is that what you're saying, that clarity, that honesty, in a really understandable way?
Yeah, I think it is. And I'm not saying that conversation is easy to have either. With some of our families, I've got to be honest with you, I've thought, oh, I've got to have this conversation. But actually what I have found is, once you get past that and they begin to understand what it is that we're saying, we're not saying you have done this. What we're saying is we have noticed this and we can change it. So it's about saying, you know what, that's how it was. That's not how it needs to be. And I found that with some of the families that I have worked with is that they've actually, it's like that light bulb moment of going, oh my goodness, why didn't somebody just sit me down and say, this is where we need to do a little bit more work and need to have that understanding. And for some of those families that I have worked with, it's that they think it takes lots of time and it's time that they haven't got because they're juggling so many balls. But when you actually sit them down and say, it doesn't take that much time. It isn't. It can be part of everything else that you're doing.
That's really empowering to hear that actually it's such a positive message where neglect is that your experience, Lisa, in relation to some of the difficulties with assessment? Are there particular elements of neglect that you think practitioners might struggle to understand and identify and clarify for families?
Yeah, I certainly do. I think we've certainly worked with families and actually thinking about those families from more affluent areas, you know, they may well have a lovely house, a tidy house. The children have got not only good quality clothes, but, you know, sometimes designer brands, but actually the lack of supervision for those children. You know, they're given money to go out, but parents don't know where they are. Some of the elements of safety or some of the elements of emotional warmth, you know, the quality of the relationship. So in kind of a physical world, they have everything they could ever want and more. But actually, emotionally, they're being left behind, you know, some of their peers from less affluent areas.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing we're wary of is that for some families, this is how they were brought up. And actually us saying you're neglecting your children is the realization for them that they were neglected as children. And actually, sometimes they're not ready to hear that. You know, sometimes we are challenging not only their family and how they're bringing their children up, but how their parents brought them up. And sometimes that realization was, you know what, if I'm neglecting my children, I was neglected too. And they've never seen that before, you know, and they've got to work through that themselves too.
Yeah. That's really powerful, isn't it? Sharon, there's one of the kind of issues we're aware of is, as you say, by the time, you know, you can understand and see the extremes, especially if it's in the physical environment. But how do you think practitioners cope with understanding when suboptimal parenting, stuff which is not that good, becomes neglectful parenting? Because that bit in the middle is quite challenging, isn't it? Have you got any experience or any thoughts around that?
Yeah, it's the not quite good enough area, isn't it? That bit in the middle. And I think that practitioners really struggle with that. In my experience, it is a difficult position to be in, especially where you have a number of professionals working with a family and different people are seeing different things. Communication then is key, so that everybody's on the same page. And certainly there are families that I've been aware of who have had some professionals say, no, you're doing a brilliant job, everything's wonderful, your house is clean, everything's great. And then others seeing the different perspective of it. And without that communication, that becomes really difficult for practitioners to kind of move families on and out of that kind of grey area. Yeah. I think it's really hard. Practitioners, in my experience, find it, the word neglect is so negative and has such a stigma attached to it, that we try and avoid it as much as possible. But actually, that isn't what should be done. It's all about the transparency. Mm. I think things can drift if things are just about good enough. And the earlier identification of neglect is actually quite challenging, because we do think about, you know, it's going back to the filthy children and the filthy houses. And if it gets to that point, it's too late. We've missed an opportunity. And this is children's lives that we're talking about. So I think it's a really difficult position for a practitioner to be in. But I do think that that's societal as well. Nobody likes the term neglect, do they? And it does spring the most horrendous images into your mind. But just picking up on something that Lisa said about the more affluent families, and particularly with young children, you can go into beautiful homes, but there aren't any toys available for the children to play with. There's a TV, you know, 50-inch screen TV in the corner with the moving wallpaper on it all the time, but no interaction. And I do think that that's really difficult, as having been a practitioner faced with that situation myself in the past and working with families like that, it's really difficult then to have those challenging conversations with parents and trying to then bring in that term neglect is very difficult. So that bit in the middle is a very challenging area, yeah. I find.
So moving on to small children and an assessment of neglect, Mandy, have you got any experience of working with really small children around neglect? So 0 to 5, say, and maybe it's pre-verbal or non-verbal. So some of the challenges with kind of non-verbal babies in relation to neglect. Have you got any kind of thoughts around that?
We've noticed that there's been that kind of like eye contact, or you know, some baby will go to anybody, especially a young child, to be soothed, and normally that's kind of like not something that would happen. It's, you know, the baby would be in the pram and you could pick the baby up and soothe that child, but tended to be mom wouldn't even go and look. She'd go, oh, just cries all the time, you know. And it's kind of like that, actually they need that bit of soothing, but you could see there was no kind of like eye contact or wanting to touch the baby or wanting to do anything to try and soothe the baby. And it's that kind of like, okay, you may have had a really bad night's sleep on this occasion and you may well be tired and worn out. But if you go on and we've been on the next occasion and the same things happen, and you start to think, you know, there's no emotional warmth there. Yeah. We need to really look at this.
So have you any experience of trying to understand the lived experience of a very small baby? Because obviously when children grow up and get a bit older and a bit verbal, and you can try and understand their lived experience, but it's much more difficult, isn't it, when they're non-verbal. Have you any thoughts about how people can do that?
I would start looking at how that eye contact is and how that physical contact is with baby. You know, it's having those little toys and playing those little games. And for all they only may be a couple of weeks or a couple of months old, they can still play with those things. And it's like saying, like in my experience, what I've found is I've said to them, sing songs to them. They'll watch your mouth movements. You're encouraging them. You know, it's okay. You may think that they're not getting anything from it, but they actually are. They're watching you. They're learning from you. So it's kind of, for me, when I've been in and worked with families like that, it's looking for those things to see if they happen, to see if that kind of engagement, and actually encouraging it And sometimes they find that they think, or in my experience of that, they've gone, but I feel a bit daft doing that because my parents didn't do that with me. So I feel stupid. And you go, no, you'll get so much when baby smiles. You'll get so much when they try to copy your, it's amazing. Just watch. So it is that kind of like.
That's brilliant, isn't it? That's really helpful. Sharon, did you want to come in at this point?
Yeah, just with regards to that, a lot of my working life has been spent in children's centres, so with under fives predominantly, and a lot of very new parents who may have additional needs themselves, or may, as was mentioned earlier, may have been parented not in the best way when they were young. And I think the use of observation and role modelling is absolutely key when we've got practitioners there. Taking families along to toddler groups, for instance, so that they can engage with other families and other children, and they can watch how other parents might be interacting with their children. But the use of observation and role modelling is absolutely key. It's always a concern, and I've worked with many families over the years that when you've gone into the home, the youngest child is always in a playpen with the same book and the same cuddly toy that they were the week before on the visit, and the week before that, and the week before that. And the child is always very quiet. And that's always an alarm bell for me. If you've got a very quiet child under the age of five, then something's not quite right. And when you've got a very quiet child that's always in a playpen and has very little interaction with their parent, that's when really practically you can get involved in the, right, come on, let's get baby out. Let's see what we can do here. Let's have a look. What toys have you got? What we can do? Even if it's a bunch of keys, it's about getting that attachment, building on that. It's so important for the brain development at such an early age. And then getting them out of the house and getting them integrated into society and able to experience from seeing how other families and how the parents interact with their children. It also helps them with some of the families that I've worked with, where financial pressures have been quite great and they haven't been able to have lots of resources in the home. If they can get out and go to a toddler group or stay and play in a children's centre or something like that, they can access all of those opportunities without having the pressure of thinking, oh gosh, I need to go out and buy that new toy that I've seen advertised on the TV. Yeah. Because that's going to do everything I need it to do. The interaction between the parent or the caregiver and the child is far better than any whiz bang toy that you could buy that's new on the market.
Absolutely agree. Lisa, have you got experience of neglect in the early years?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of my background is early years too. But for me, it is that demonstrating. So and telling parents that, you know, talking to your baby, even if it's right, we're going to change your nappy, we're going to do this, and sort of narrating as you're doing some of the care needs, and allowing that turn taking in conversation. Yes, baby's babbling, yes, baby doesn't understand so much what we're saying, but it's those starts of that social interactions, and sort of just picking up really from what Sharon was saying about resources. It's showing them, you know, let's go and get a wooden spoon. Have you got a bowl, a mixing bowl? What else can we make? You know, because we put some pasta in some empty pot bottles to make a shaker. But telling, sort of talking about the importance of the interaction as opposed to the toy. You know, the most important thing in a young baby's life is that caregiver. And we can do so much as caregivers, you know, singing, and you know, I am from a nursery background, so I'm happy to sing songs in somebody's house, whether I can sing very well or not. I'm happy to do it and to show them and show them sort of some of the little bits from the social baby. So sticking my tongue out and waiting for baby to copy, and showing them those little things that baby can pick up, and it is really vital for them.
Another interesting thing, isn't it, is that as they get older, they say don't start trying to parent adolescents when they're adolescents. And so I'm just interested in anyone's thoughts on adolescents really, and the challenges with neglect and how it actually appears for adolescents, because I think as they get older, the neglect that they've experienced as they're young, it's very difficult to attribute behaviour when they're 14, 15 and 16 to something that happened, you know, the neglect that they've experienced during their life. So has anybody got any thoughts and views around that? Mandy, have you got any thoughts and views around adolescent neglect and working with adolescents?
My background before this was targeted services, so I worked with a lot of families that historically you could do. They tended to, it's kind of like they get into that criminality because they're looking for that sense of loyalty, that sense of belonging. And I think that's another thing with that people don't really see is linked to neglect. It's that what that gang culture can offer is that that closeness, that bond, that sense of belonging, that camaraderie that comes with it. They've got no problem with hugging each other and, you know, giving that bit of a nudge, and it's kind of, and they, when you look back, you can actually see that it's that emotional need that it's feeding, and it's that family bond that they get within that. And it's something that I found whilst working, you know, within that sector, that whenever you kind of like unpicked everything, you usually found that from an early age they were out on the streets playing and not going to school. And,
yeah. So neglect is it's like a horizontal, isn't it? It underlies a lot of behaviour which is seen as risk taking or getting involved in criminality as they get older. Lisa, is that your experience? Because I know you've worked with 0-19 teams as well.
Yes, I think it is, and it is difficult for people to track back. And sometimes, certainly when we're working with families and we're asking about early years, families don't quite get why we're asking about that, and yet for us it's sort of seeing some of the things that Mandy was talking about there. Actually, you know, yes, we can then track back and say this is why some of those behavioural difficulties may be happening, this is why, you know, there might be gravitating towards some of the gangs or some of the criminal exploitation, and I think for us, we found having that trusted adult who is a champion for the child sometimes can just bring some of that back. You know, a child needs to know somebody's on their side. And I think especially if they have got behavioural issues, you know, they may well be causing difficulties in schools. It may be that teachers see them as a problem as opposed to looking at what happened, so sort of having somebody in their corner to sort of say, you know, this could just be that they need something extra, they've missed something when they were younger.
Because it's really interesting, isn't it, for adolescents, and we know neglect is an adverse childhood experience, and we know that anger is a mask emotion when you're traumatized. And so sometimes when they become adolescents, if we don't understand this, all that society sees are angry young individuals, where actually what they're really seeing is traumatized young people who have not had their needs met as they're growing up. Is that your experience, Sharon? Is that how you understand adolescent neglect?
Yeah, very much so. A lot of the young people that I've encountered who are involved in criminal behaviours have, when you track back and you look at their histories, the neglect was from very young ages. It's that need to feel needed. They want to become part of a family, and what that family looks like will be something they will want that to look very different to what their family at home looks like. The behaviours go off the scale. We end up with school exclusions, which gives them further exposure to risk and exploitation. Mm. That, you know, when you've got young people who've had no attachment with their parents or little attachment with their parents, the parents don't notice the changes in their behaviours as much. They just think, oh, they're just being naughty because they've always been naughty. And for some of the young people that haven't had the best of everything at home, when they become involved with some of the gangs who can then buy them the latest trainers or give them the group of friends they want, or they can get into somebody's car and go off somewhere for the evening, then that's what they're going to do because they've missed all of that. And we also need to remember that teenagers go through another brain growth spurt, which impacts on their emotions. And, you know, it's very difficult to be a teenager, especially in the current climate with things, with society and with the risks out there that there are now. And I think that it's really important. But again, just to echo what Lisa said, when you go back and you talk to families about the early childhood experiences, they can't see the connection and then therefore perhaps can't see their role in the responsibility around that. And certainly some young people as well, they don't seem to have the kind of sense of self-respect that they may have had they have had that kind of relationship as they were growing up. They won't engage in them with medical appointments because there was no emphasis put on medical appointments and developmental checks, etc., when they were younger. So it's not something that they would see as a high priority.
So when you're assessing neglect in adolescence, it moves from kind of the kind of the quality of the care and the effort that the parents are putting into the how they're supporting their growth and their development, isn't it? So it kind of changes, the subtlety changes, because obviously if a three-year-old has not been dressed appropriately, then actually that's an issue with the parenting, isn't it? But actually when you become an adolescent, you want to make sure that parents are supporting that child. So assessment and working is really difficult for practitioners, isn't it? In relation to children with additional needs, Lisa, have you got any experience of working where there's been neglect of children who've got these who require extra support?
Yeah, certainly. And I think it's difficult because as a practitioner, you have got to have that additional information of, okay, what does this child need additionally? And, you know, what we know with children with additional needs, their needs can be great. And in sometimes you need to be an expert in those needs, which as a practitioner, we might not always be. So for me, it's finding who is the expert of that child's needs. How do we work with that expert for us to understand what the child needs? And how does the parent respond to those additional needs? You know, is the parent interested enough? Have they got an understanding of what the additional needs mean for the child? Do they know what it means if they don't follow through on some of the medical advice? Do they understand the consequences for not following sort of medical advice and opinion? Or is it when they've walked into the room at say a consultant's that they haven't understood what the consultant's saying, you know? And how do we A, make them understand, and then to ensure that they're following those needs?
Yeah. So what I've heard from the conversation we've had thus far is around honesty with families. It's around clarity about actually what each child needs at each part of its development, whether it needs what it needs as a baby, what it needs as it's growing up, what that child needs as an adolescent. And that idea of don't start to parent an adolescent, as you were saying, Mandy, when they're an adolescent, you need to start parenting them when they're four. And even for those children who've got additional needs, it's around understanding what those needs are. And so not meeting those needs, not meeting the basic needs, and for children with additional needs, not meeting those additional needs, that can be all kind of encompassed in the idea of this suboptimal, neglectful parenting.
We hope you found this episode interesting. Please do listen to the second part, where Dawn, Mandy, Sharon and Lisa talk about the visibility of the child, early intervention, and what can be done to help parents when there is neglect in the family. And a special thank you needs to go to Sam Kiriakou, one of the NSPCC's implementation managers, for getting each of our professionals on board to speak on these two podcasts.
Thanks for listening to this NSPCC Learning podcast. At the time of recording, this episode's content was up to date, but the world of safeguarding and child protection is ever changing. So, if you're looking for the most current safeguarding and child protection training, information or resources, please visit our website for professionals at nspcc.org.uk/learning.